Okay, good morning, everybody. Who's got a whistle? All right, so we're going to get started. This is Bio 231, and it is January 21st, Wednesday, our only meeting of the week. Hope you had a nice break. I did. And I just want to talk about how students can find their way getting into this class. There's still a lot of students that want to try and add this class. So the way that you can add this class is to go to a lab, and the schedule is in the schedule of classes, and ask the instructor, is there availability? And if there is room in that lab, then she'll let me know and I can give you an add code. So if you can get into lab, you can get into lecture. I got a couple extra seats here. Where there are not extra seats are in the laboratory. And when a student drops during the first week, I always let their lab instructor know so we can find another student to take their place. And I just don't have that information. I don't know how many students are in your particular lab. Right, so you got to go and ask the lab instructor, and then they'll forward your name to me and I can give you an add code. And then you got to add this week, I believe. Okay, so that's the deal with adding. I can only help you out if the lab instructor gives me the high sign that it's okay to do that. Okay, any questions about adding the class? Is there a lab after class today? Yeah, so if you're interested in adding, go to that lab and query that lab instructor and see if there is room. I don't think there is room, but you just never know. Right? Somebody might make up their mind, like right now, that they're going to drop the class for whatever reason. Maybe they're moving, you know, to Carolina or something. Who knows, right? And so they can't take the class. So I'm just not aware. Okay, then the other thing that I want to talk about is the study guide. And that's what you use to prepare for the test. Of course, coming to lecture is very important. And of course, you do have to sign in every time. So here is a sign-in sheet for today. Please sign in, pass it around the class, and when you're done with the top after class, maybe bring it down to me, okay? But make sure you sign in. Find your name right there. That's an older roster. If you don't find your name, you really might be added to your lab. I'm not sure because that's from last week, right? But if there is dropped next to your name, then chances are you're dropped, and that could be a problem, all right? So check that out on this sheet right here. All right, so getting ready for a lecture test, you got to print out the study guide. Where would you find the study guide? Blackboard. On Blackboard. And that's where we have lecture notes for you to download, print out. And in the study guide, it tells you what objectives are important for a particular chapter. And it tells you what exam figures I might photocopy and put on the test. And it will tell you what questions in the book that I like that you can practice answering. Multiple choice questions, fill in the blank, and those answers are in the back of the book. So you can get a lot of reinforcement if you're studying properly. My lectures focus on material. No, the tests focus on material that I cover in lecture. All right, so I choose material from the chapters that I think are important. And also on the study guide, for every test, there are two. One study guide just has a list of everything you should know, including the exam figures, a list of exam figures. A second study guide has everything the first study guide has, plus all of the JPEGs of the possible figures I could put on the test, with the answers erased off of them so you can practice labeling those pictures over and over and over again. So I would expect that just about everybody should be able to get 100% on that part of the test, right? If it takes you, maybe you have to label all those pictures four times or five times, that's like 3 points on the test. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Do you have
a specific date? Yeah, it's on your syllabus. It's not in my mind, but it's on the very last page. February 9. Oh, good, that's not today. Okay. Not next week either. Might be the week after, though. All right. So, yeah, I have a schedule. Schedule is at the end of the syllabus. Okay. All right, so any questions about organization? How you get into class, how you study, that kind of stuff? Oh, yes. Hi, I have an announcement from your SI leader. Anybody in SI? Oh, let me just stop you. Sorry. Anybody in SI here? Okay, don't raise your hand yet. Do you like SI? Now raise your hand if you like it. Okay.
All right. Just wanted to let everybody know we're doing the sessions Monday and Wednesday, 8 to 10 in the morning. I added Friday, 12:30 to 1:30 to see. We're going to do it this week to see how many people come and how many people is able with their schedule to make it. If not a lot of people come, I might take it out. So I just added it because I got a few emails saying that they had lab or they had something to do Monday or Wednesday at that time. So I just added it to see who wants to take advantage of it. You can ask your peers, whoever is coming to the SI. We have already gone over chapter 1 and 2. If any of the guys that are coming to SI wants to add anything to it, it's really helpful. So you guys should take advantage of it.
Right on. Thanks for help. Okay, so we were talking about Oregon Hells last time, and I noticed that on my slides, there is one that's left off on my slides that's on your sheet. Okay? I think that is true. Oh, that looks really dim today. Uh-oh. What does that mean? Does that mean I'm going to lose my projector? That just means I got to turn all the lights off. That's all. That's why all the lights were off in here. Can you see? A little bit better. Okay. I don't think I can turn any more lights off, though. Oh, I can. Ooh. Is that better? Can you take notes? Is that worse? That's good enough? Okay. I don't know if I like that, because everybody could leave and I wouldn't even know. All right, so we're talking organelles, and the one that's on your list that I don't have on my list on the screen is, I would show you, but I don't have it. Okay, but it comes right after lysosome. Now, I do want you to know these organelles by what they look like, their structure, but I also want you to know what their function is, right? Because it's always important to know structure and function relationships. And the one that is on your list, actually, let's start here with a secretory vesicle. A vesicle is a membrane-bound structure inside the cell. It's just like a balloon floating around inside the cell, carrying material. And if it's a secretory vesicle, what is that little balloon carrying around? Or what's the fate of the material that's inside that vesicle or inside that little balloon? It's going to be expelled from the cell. We call that secretion. All right, so something whose fate is destined to leave the cell is carried to the plasma membrane by a secretory vesicle. It's just a spherical little membrane with junk on the inside. A lysosome is another kind of membrane-bound vesicle with junk on the inside. And who can tell me what stuff is on the inside of a lysosome? Digestive enzymes. Right, digestive enzymes. We went over that. So, for instance, if a bacteria enters a cell, the cell can surround it with this lysosome, and since there's digestive enzymes in the lysosome, it will digest the bacteria, and then the bacterium dies and can't infect the cell. That's one particular purpose of a lysosome. And it can also be used for recycling intracellular components so that it can be used again. There's an important biomolecule called a protein. Does anybody know what the building block of a protein is? Amino acid, you probably heard that before you even came to college, right? So if there's a protein and your cell wants to recycle it, it digests it back down to amino acids, and then your cell can use those building blocks to build other kinds of proteins that it needs. That's the job of a lysosome. Now, what's not on my slide, but's on your paper, is a peroxisome. That's a vesicle. It's not on there? You don't have peroxisome? I got it on mine. I thought I downloaded it from somebody's, from one of your sections here. You have ribosome after this. No. All right, ribosomes are important. Peroxisome? All right, I'm not going to talk about it then until I update everybody's file. But I'll tell you real quick. A peroxisome is sort of like a lysosome, but it has enzymes in it that can detoxify toxic compounds that the cell produces. So a lysosome is a digestive system. A peroxisome is a detoxification center. Let's see if you can see this. Peroxisome for detoxification. Okay, now somebody was saying something about ribosome. That's on my list. I have it as number three, but it's not number three here. A ribosome is important for protein synthesis, and that's just a little dot inside the cell. That's where all proteins are made. That's the workbench where proteins are made at. Like, where would you mix up stuff to bake a cake? To bake a cake in your kitchen, what would you use? Yeah, but I mean the place where you do it. You put all the stuff inside a bowl. Where's the bowl sitting? Yeah, like on the countertop, right? So a ribosome is like the countertop where your cell makes proteins. All right, that's what a ribosome is. It's the workbench where proteins are made. Okay. And I think that's all I want to talk about in terms of that. Now we're going to move to the nucleus. Overall, what's the function of the nucleus? Or what's inside the nucleus? Yeah, there's DNA. There are chromosomes inside the nucleus, and chromosomes are made out of DNA. And that's very important because your chromosomes carry the blueprint on how to build your body. So there's information in DNA on how to build your body. That's one thing. The second thing in DNA are instructions on how your structure should function, how your body functions. So that information tells how to build your body, but also how it should function as well. That information, that's inside the nucleus, and that's very important information. It shouldn't be lost. It shouldn't be damaged. You can think of it like a computer program inside your computer. And every once in a while, a computer program will start to misbehave. It becomes corrupted. And what's a solution to fixing a program in your computer that stops working properly? What can you do with your computer? Sometimes you can turn your computer off and turn it back on. It reloads the program. Sometimes that doesn't help. What you have to do is erase the program and then reload it into your computer from a disk. Go back to the factory software. But a cell, when its information gets corrupted, guess what happens to the cell? It can't reload that information from anywhere. That cell just dies. So that information is very, very important. So the job of the nucleus is to protect the information that's in DNA, so it doesn't get corrupted, because if it does, then the cell dies. Yeah?
Can I put some question about the DNA? Is that the same DNA for all the cells inside the body, or is that different DNA for different parts of the cell?
Okay. There are two places where you have DNA in your body. One place is in the nucleus. That's the most important place. But there is another organelle that has its own DNA. And it actually kind of looks like a bacterium, and that is the mitochondria. I think we talked about that last time, the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria, right? The most important is the DNA that's inside the nucleus that defines who you are, but there's a little tiny fragment of DNA in mitochondria as well that helps regulate mitochondria, okay? So that's how I would answer that question. All right, so what does that nucleus look like? We can think of some structures associated with the nucleus. All right, they're chromosomes. They're made out of DNA. And DNA is made up of, the building block of DNA are what we call nucleic acids, or nucleotides. All right, and these nucleic acids are packaged around proteins called histones. And when DNA is packaged on a histone, it's very, very safe. It can't get damaged. The trade-off to that is when, for instance, this is how I think of a chromosome. Like when you go on a trip, And what are you going to take with you when you go on a trip? You got a toothbrush. You've got some toothpaste. You got a brush, maybe a comb. You got some shirts and some pants, maybe a swimsuit, right? And when you hop out, what else do you have? Maybe your passport, all kinds of stuff you take with you, right? And when you walk on the plane, are you carrying all that stuff in your two arms like that? Maybe some t-shirts, some pants, right? Toothbrush, comb, hair dryer. You walk on a plane like that. What happens if you get on a plane with all that stuff like that? You might lose something, right? So what do? You put it in a suitcase so it's packaged nice so you don't lose any of it. That's what a chromosome does. That's the job of the histone. It takes all of that material, all that DNA, and it packages it up so that it can't get damaged. But if you want to brush your hair with a brush and it's in your suitcase, can you use it?
No.
No. Things that are protected and packaged away can't be used, including the DNA. So in order for the cell to use that information in DNA, it's got to be taken off of a histone molecule. That's like opening up your luggage and taking out whatever you want to use. Right? It's safe if it's in that luggage, right? But if you take it out, what could happen? You could lose it. You could forget it in the hotel room. Someone else might find it and find it useful. Who knows what could happen, right? So that's what the histone does. And when DNA is wrapped on histone molecules to keep it protected, to keep it from being corrupted, we say it is condensed chromatin. It's nice and safe. And it's really dark and thick, and you can see it underneath a light microscope. So condensed chromatin is protected, but what's the trade-off if it's protected?
Can't be used
for protein synthesis. So when your cell wants to use that information, it has to pull the DNA off histones, and then it becomes really, really thin and delicate. We call that extended chromatin. And that's when it can be used, but if it can be used, what's the trade-off? It can be damaged during that time. Right. So that's the job of the nucleus. Here's the nucleus right here. This is rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here is the nuclear envelope. There's a membrane, and the job of the membrane is to just regulate how things can move either in or out of the nucleus. This helps regulate the flow of information. And in this region right here, right, there's chromatin. I don't see any chromosomes right here, but still the chromatin is extended. So they're very fine filaments. It looks pretty homogeneous, pretty uniform over the whole nucleus. But I do see a spot inside the nucleus. It's called the nucleolus. Some people say nucleolus. That's fine with me. Whatever you can do to pronounce it, to spell it correctly, probably helps. Right? Nucleolus. And the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. That's where one of the first steps of protein synthesis is taking place. Right? So the nucleolus is actually a better way of saying that, is the most active part of the nucleus. And we'll relate this to protein synthesis at the end of this chapter. Okay. Well, let me just talk about this rough endoplasmic reticulum just a little bit that we see right here. These little dots are ribosomes. And that's not on your list, but you should certainly write that down. And the job of a ribosome is to make a protein, protein synthesis. And ribosomes can be located on this membrane system right here we call endoplasmic reticulum, and notice it makes it look like sandpaper or something, gives it a rough look. So we call that rough endoplasmic reticulum. So the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is protein synthesis because it has the workbench for making proteins associated with it. Ribosomes that are floating around in the cytosol over here, not attached to a membrane, have the same function. They make proteins. But those proteins just end up in the cytosol floating around inside the cell, doing whatever job they were supposed to be doing. All right, so you might be wondering, why does a cell, at least our cells that are very sophisticated, why do we have all of these fine structures, exquisite structures inside the cell? Why is it that there's a nucleus? All right, why is it that there's a mitochondria or rough endoplasmic reticulum and smooth endoplasmic reticulum? Why not just have all these things working together inside the cell? What's the function of an organelle? Not a particular organelle, but what generally, what's the function of all the organelles? Why do our sophisticated cells have organelles, and some forms of life, like bacteria, they don't have any organelles? Why do we have organelles? Anybody think about that? I stayed up nights thinking about that. Okay. Well, so let's think of a building, like the SEM building right here. Is it just one big auditorium? And what happened, what would happen in this building if it was just one big auditorium? If the walls of the building were like the plasma membrane of the cell and everybody just walked into the building and it was one big room, what would that be like?
Chaos.
Yeah, I like that word, chaos, right? So the job of organelles is to specialize certain kinds of functions, right, or isolate certain functions within the cell so that they don't interfere with other functions that are going on. For instance, if the SEM building was one big room, we would have a physics lecture and a couple math lectures and anatomy and physiology and geology all going on at the same time. Well, that might seem really efficient where you could just show up for 1 hour and you could learn geology and math and anatomy and physiology all at the same time. But would it work? No, because each one of those, right, each lecture would interfere with another lecture and nothing would get accomplished. So the same thing for a cell. There are organelles inside the cell so that protein synthesis can take place inside what organelle? Ref endoplasmic reticulum. And so that lipid synthesis could take place in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum so that things could be digested in a lysosome, right? So that microtubules could move things around inside the cell and that the Golgi apparatus could package and modify chemical compounds, and all of that could be going on at the same time without interference with each other. So that's why a cell has all these organelles with specialized functions, so that all that can happen at one time without interference. All right, so you should probably appreciate that a little bit. All right. Anybody have a question on organelles? And since this is anatomy, you should know what they look like too, right? Because a picture of the cell, that's an exam figure. So you should know what they look like. The function of the nuclear pores is to allow molecules to move in and out of the nucleus. Only special molecules that the nucleus decides wants to move back and forth, but not everything. So the function of the nuclear envelope is to protect the DNA from corruption, from being destroyed.
Question.
Yeah. Organelles prevent interference with different kinds of functions inside the cell, so that protein synthesis can take place, and lipid synthesis, and detoxification, and packaging and modification. So they all can happen at one time without interference. That's what the job of an organelle is. To allow special functions, to allow many special functions to take place at one time in the cell without interference. That's what an organelle, well, that's what the organelles are for. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the plasma membrane. One of the jobs of the plasma membrane is to allow things that the cell needs on its interior access to the inside of the cell. It allows the cells to take things up that it needs. Might be important energy molecules. Can anybody think of an important energy molecule that your cells need?
ATP.
The cell builds its own ATP, so it doesn't really need to import ATP. You don't really sit down at a dinner table, for instance, and eat ATP necessarily. All right, we eat energy. And it's those molecules that have to get inside the cell to make ATP. So there's no reason why you would have an idea of what that molecule is without taking some more classes, but I thought I would just ask. Okay. So one important energy molecule that cells need to take up to make ATP is glucose. And I think maybe some people are familiar with glucose because there's a disease process where somebody can't regulate their blood glucose levels. What's that disease process called? That's diabetes. So you're sort of familiar with what I'm talking about a little bit. Right, so the plasma membrane regulates how the cell takes up important molecules that it needs, like glucose, to make ATP. It also helps regulate and gets rid of substances that might be toxic to the cell. So the cell membrane is important for that. So it moves things around. And there are two methods whereby things can move across the cell membrane. And the first kind of mechanism is what we call a passive transport process. Passive means that it just happens all the time, but it doesn't require energy. It happens all by itself, does not require energy. That's a passive process, as opposed to an active process that requires energy of some kind in order for that to happen. So those two processes are either active or passive. So let's talk about each one of these. Well, I tell you what, let's relate it to a car. Okay, and a car can either be, let's say this car can be down at the base of a hill, or it could be up at the top of a hill. All right, and in order to go from the bottom to the top, is that an active process or passive? That's active. What energy molecule does a car need to get to the top? It needs gasoline, in most cars anyway, right? All right, but when the car is on the top of the hill, can it get down to the bottom of the hill without gasoline? Absolutely. That is what kind of process? Active or passive? That's passive, right? So from going from high to low, that's passive, doesn't require any energy. Going from low to high requires energy to do that. All right, so one process that is passive is what we call diffusion. And this is a process where molecules can move from high concentration to low concentration, just like that car going from high on the hill down to the base of the hill. That happens all by itself. So for instance, if I were to open up a perfume bottle right here, and is there a fan blowing air around in here? Do you see a fan anywhere blowing? Do you feel a breeze? Are your papers ruffling on your desk? No. So the air is just kind of stationary here. But if I were to open up that perfume bottle, and even though there's no currents in the room, guess what's going to happen to that perfume when it starts to evaporate into the air? Would you be able to smell it? You know what? It's actually going to move from right here to the first row of seats, right? You're going to smell it first, and then it's going to move to the second row and third row, and then finally at the end of the lecture, even people way in the back are going to be able to smell that perfume. Because that perfume can move all by itself from high concentration by the perfume bottle to everywhere where the concentration is low, which is where, all the way in the back of the room. Right? So that perfume bottle can move all by itself, even though there's nobody blowing it around in the room. We call that diffusion. And diffusion can take place in air, and it can take place in a liquid like water, but it can't take place in a solid, because all those molecules are glued in position. They can't move around. But if it's a fluid, it can move. And gas is a fluid and liquid is a fluid. We call that diffusion. And that's how our bodies take up an important chemical compound like oxygen. All right, oxygen moves into our cells by diffusion. And don't forget, diffusion is a passive process. What does that mean? How do things move by diffusion? From low to high or high to low? High to low by diffusion. So in order for oxygen to be taken up by our cells, where does oxygen concentration have to be the lowest? Okay, is it in the air the lowest or in the cells the lowest for oxygen to go in the cells? It's low in the cells. Yeah, you might have to actually think about that one. It's kind of a tricky thing, right? It's high in the air. Is low in the cells, so oxygen automatically just goes from the air into our cells because of this principle right here called diffusion. All right, and that's a passive process. There is another process called osmosis. It's a little bit more special because osmosis is just like diffusion in that it is passive, right? But it pertains only to the water molecule. So for osmosis, how can water move? From high to low or low to high? Always from high to low if it's passive, just like a car rolling down a hill. All right, and the other criteria for osmosis is that water can't just move from an area of high concentration to low, but it actually has to pass through a membrane. Could you give me an example of a membrane? Like the cell membrane or plasma membrane? So when water moves from high concentration to low across the plasma membrane, we call that osmosis, and that's a passive process. Okay, so osmosis has to be the water molecule, and the membrane has to be semipermeable. And a good example of a semipermeable membrane is a plasma membrane, because a plasma membrane doesn't let everything through. Only certain chemicals can go through the plasma membrane. So it selects only things that the cell needs. All right, so that's passive transport. Active transport, on the other hand, needs what?
Gasoline.
That's got to be one of my favorite molecules. All right. But in your body, you can't use gasoline. You got to use ATP, right? That's the energy molecule that fuels your body. Your body regenerates it, kind of not like a car. Your car doesn't regenerate gasoline, but your body regenerates ATP. I wish it could. That's going to be a cool technology when we can figure out how to You know how much energy is lost when you burn gasoline in your car? How much energy you just throw away? 70% of it. When you burn gasoline, only 30% is used to move your car around. 70% just is lost as heat. Wouldn't it be nice to take that 70% and do something with it? Oh, yeah, that would be really cool. So anyway, what your body does is that it has gasoline, and it knows how to resynthesize it from other energy molecules like glucose that we eat. Okay, and processes inside your body that require energy are called active. All right, and so ATP can be broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and when it does, that releases energy. Your body can use that energy to do its biological business, like muscle contraction, or to think thoughts, for instance, or to digest something. ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. What does tri mean?
Three.
There's three of something, and the something is phosphate. It's a phosphate molecule, inorganic phosphate molecule. So adenosine has three of these phosphate molecules on it. Adenosine diphosphate only has two. That's why we call it a diphosphate. Di means two. And when that third phosphate breaks away from ATP, that releases a chemical energy that can be used by your body. Okay, and that chemical energy can be used to run these active transport processes. All right, so remember, if a passive process means something can go from only high to low, an active process means it can go from low to high. You can concentrate molecules in your body. You can take glucose in very low concentration and store it in your cell at high concentration. That won't happen automatically. What do you need for that to happen? You need energy to take glucose at a low concentration and put it in, like a bottle of high concentration. That takes energy, that takes ATP to do that. We call that active transport. All right, so a good example, molecular transport, particle or macromolecular transport, that just means something bigger. Maybe it's a particle that you can almost see with your naked eye, something that's not dissolved in solution. There are three processes right here: phagocytosis, pinocytosis, and exocytosis. Cytosis just means some kind of cellular process, something happening inside the cell. And this first part of the word, and I think these are all coming from Greek, phago means eating. All right? And so that just means cell eating. This is when a cell can actually surround a particle that it wants inside the cell. It surrounds a particle, it forms a vesicle, and then that vesicle breaks away from the plasma membrane, and now that vesicle is floating around inside the cell. It used to be outside the cell, now it's inside the cell. The same thing can happen for if a cell wants to drink something that's in solution. And that's pino. Pino means drinking. And cytosis means cell process. This is a cell process for drinking fluids. This is how a cell can import fluids inside the cell. So phagocytosis and pinocytosis are specific examples of bringing materials from outside the cell to inside the cell, and that has another name. That's called, anybody know, anybody read the chapter on that part? That's called endocytosis, E-N-D-O. Endocytosis is bringing material inside the cell, and endocytosis could be either phagocytosis or pinocytosis, depending on the nature of the material. All right, and does that process, does endocytosis require energy? Endocytosis, remember, endocytosis is just a general form of phagocytosis and pinocytosis. Does that require energy? Yes, because we have it here under the active transport mechanisms. So the cell membrane actually has to change shape, right? It's got to form around whatever the material is outside the cell. So the microtubules have to be pushing and pulling and moving these membranes around, and that takes energy to do that. That takes ATP to do that. Okay. Exocytosis, on the other hand, is just when the cell spits something out. Whenever there's a vesicle inside the cell and that vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, actually it just doesn't move over there. It is moved over there by microtubules and the use of ATP. That vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, and then whatever inside that vesicle gets released to the outside of the cell. That's what we call exocytosis. All right, so endo is phago plus pino together. Exocytosis is just a process all by itself. All right. So where do we have a process? Okay. So here, this is what we call a secretory pathway. This is a pretty good picture in your book. What's the name of this organelle right here? Rough endoplasmic reticulum, and the function is protein synthesis because it has ribosomes on it. And when a ribosome synthesizes a protein, oh, I think it's just this previous one right here. Here's a ribosome, and when it makes a protein, that protein gets placed right into the interior of the endoplasmic reticulum. We call that a cisterna. That's just a special place inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And here's just the cytosol outside the ER. So now this protein is trapped inside the endoplasmic reticulum. It can't float everywhere inside the cell. It's inside the ER. So let's go back. All right. So the proteins are inside the endoplasmic reticulum, and then a bud forms. It bulges out from the endoplasmic reticulum. So what's going to be inside this little bud right here? Proteins that are made by the ribosomes that are on the outside of the reticulum. And then the vesicle breaks away, and it's moved over to this thing right here. What is this organelle? That's a Golgi apparatus. You could say Golgi body. Doesn't look like a body to me, but it did to somebody. I guess it can take different forms, different shapes, because it's moving around all the time. And what's the job of the Golgi apparatus? Packaging and modification. So it's going to take this protein, and maybe it's going to break it into two to make two proteins. And when it breaks it into two, it might activate those proteins to do its job. Or maybe it's going to modify that protein by adding a sugar molecule to it, making it a sugar protein. We call that a mucopolysaccharide. And some mucopolysaccharides are very slippery and kind of viscous, and they run out your nose when you have a cold. Right? We call that mucus. Right? Mucus is a part protein, part sugar molecule joined together. That's the job of the Golgi body right here. It modifies protein somehow. Right? And then, well, you don't want that mucus running around inside the cell, right? So it's trapped by the Golgi apparatus, and then what does the Golgi apparatus do? It packages it into this vesicle. Vesicle buds away from the Golgi body and then forms a vesicle inside the cell, and then via the monorail system, this vesicle, which we call a secretory vesicle, moves over to the plasma membrane, fuses with the plasma membrane, and now that mucus can be secreted from the cell by that process. What's that process called? Exocytosis is leaving, and voila, it's outside that cell. And it might be inside of a duct or something, and that duct carries it to the outside of your body or wherever it's going to be needed. Okay. So mucus can help fight infections as well. All right, so here is a secretory pathway. So the fate of proteins made by ribosomes and RuffER end up where? Outside the cell, via the secretory pathway. Proteins that are made by ribosomes, free ribosomes, in the cytosol end up where? Can they leave the cell?
No.
Not easily. They are used inside the cell. So the fate of proteins made by ribosomes that are free stay inside the cell. The fate of enzymes that are made by ribosomes on RuffER leave the cell. They are extracellular. They're exported by some kind of secretory pathway. All right, so you can see these membranes, all these membranes are very similar. The basic building block is just a phospholipid bilayer. So they can fuse together or they can break apart, they can reform, they're very fluid in nature. And I think you can maybe picture in your mind, have you ever seen some kids, not that you would do this, but have you ever seen any kids playing with a bottle of soap and a little wand that has a hoop on it? And you stick the hoop inside the soap bottle and pull it out and then wave it in the air. And what does it make? Like a bubble. And think of that film, that soap film of water as being a plasma membrane. Yeah, I wouldn't accuse you of doing this. But anyway, think of that cell, that soap film as being the cell membrane. It's very fluid. All right. And have you ever seen, okay, that those two soap bubbles can float around and make a bunch of them, a line of soap bubbles, and they float around and they can touch each other, they can bump into each other. And when they bump into each other, sometimes they bust, right? They pop. But every once in a while when they touch each other, what happens? They connect, right? Because the soap film is identical on those two bubbles and they can form now one structure. So use that model in your mind to visualize how a membrane on a vesicle can fuse with the membrane of the cell. Right, because it has the same nature to it. They can fuse together or it can pinch apart very easily because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, just like that soap film. Okay. All right, so that's something about transport processes. One of the last things in this chapter is protein synthesis. So our bodies make protein and there's information in protein on how to build it. And when a protein is made, it has a particular structure. And what can you tell me about if something has a particular structure? It has an associated particular function, right? And if you change the structure of that protein, the function of that protein is going to change. We don't talk about that very much in this class, but in physiology we do. That's a cool thing about physiology. So we want to at least introduce to you the concept of, well, how do you make a protein? How do you build a protein? And how does that information, where does that information come from to make a protein that's eventually going to have a certain function in your body? Well, all that information is stored in your DNA, in your chromosomes. Where are those chromosomes located again? In the nucleus, right? It's in that protected area right there. Okay. Well, here is what we call the central dogma in biology. And a dogma is a system of beliefs. It's a way of thinking. It's more like a philosophy, but it's really a system of beliefs. And when you hear belief, what are you thinking about more? Are you thinking more about religion or more about science when you say belief?
Religion.
It's more like religion, right? Okay, so I know this is a science class, but I'm going to tell you about this central dogma. And the dogma is just something that you're taught that you're automatically expected to believe, right? And something that we think you can rely on, right? But in science, what are you taught? This is from the 1970s. This is before you all were born. And that is, what? Don't trust authority. Don't take anything for granted. Challenge everything, right? Well, I'm going to give you a statement here, this dogma that, right, for this class you shouldn't challenge. You should just automatically accept as true. You'll probably have to modify it as your understanding of science gets more sophisticated, but this is a really good place to start. All right, so dogma, this is a belief. So start with this place. All right, and this dogma says that information starts, all right, or is stored in DNA. That's what makes your chromosomes up. And then it's converted into another kind of molecule called RNA. And then the information in RNA is used to make proteins. So both RNA and DNA are what we call nucleic acids. The building block of a nucleic acid are nucleotides. All right, a protein, well, that's a protein and a building block of a protein. What's a building block of protein again? Amino acid. So the building block of protein is amino acid. Building block of RNA and DNA are nucleic acids. Nucleic acids. Different kind of molecules altogether compared to amino acids. And the information flows from DNA, your chromosomes, down into protein. Now, can information go from protein into RNA? Or, for instance, can a protein be used to make RNA in your body? Look at that arrow right there. What does that say? One-way street. All right. What about information in RNA? Can that be used to make information that is stored in DNA, according to the central dogma? No. It's a one-way street. Information always flows from DNA to RNA to protein. All right, so in order to make a protein, how many steps are necessary, according to this diagram right here? How many arrows do you see?
Two
arrows, that means two steps, all right? And so in this scheme of protein synthesis, I want you to know what those two steps are called and where they take place inside the cell. That's going to be important. All right, but don't forget, the first information here about this dogma is that information flows from DNA to RNA to protein. And that's probably a really good thing, to appreciate, because, for instance, tonight, you might go home and maybe you have a trout or a salmon and you're going to put that on the barbecue and eat it, and you're going to eat all of that fish protein. All right? Do you have to worry about waking up in the morning with fins and a gill? Is that going to change your body just by eating that fish, by eating that protein? No, it's not. Why? And that's because the central dogma says that information doesn't flow from protein to RNA back into your chromosomes. It goes which way? The other way, right? All right, so the fish has these fish proteins because it has the genes in those chromosomes. It has fish chromosomes. You have human proteins because you have human chromosomes, right? And if you eat a fish, you don't get the... You don't change your DNA because of that. Okay, so the two-step process. The first step is what we call transcription. So transcription is converting DNA into RNA. And where do you have DNA? Where do you have your chromosomes? Inside the nucleus. They're protected. So this first step, namely transcription, happens where? In the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. Because if it ended up in the cytoplasm when it's being used, remember the chromatin is extended, can be damaged very easily, that would probably be the death of that cell. Transcription always takes place inside the nucleus. That's their protected area. All right, and now why do we call that transcription? That's a big word. What does transcription mean? You could Google it, Wikipedia, okay? But transcription, you think of that word all the time. Because sometimes you might apply for a job and they'll want to see if you ever attended college and what kind of grades you got. Or maybe you're going to go on to another college and they want to see if you went to a college and what kind of grades you got. And so what do you ask for from your college? A transcript. And what is that? That is an exact duplicate copy of your record of whatever classes you took here at Cypress College and your grades. Right? So if I said, I want a transcript of these lecture notes right here, if this was 1,000 years ago, what would you have to do? I say, I want a transcript of my lecture notes. What would you do? You say, I'll be right back in a minute?
No.
No, you'd have to light a candle and get some kind of feather and an inkwell, right, and just copy every single letter and make a duplicate copy, right? But today, what would you do? I hope you wouldn't do that. You'd just take it to a photocopy machine and in like 10 seconds have a transcript, right? So a transcript is just a photocopy. It's pretty much an exact duplicate. So what does that say about RNA and DNA? They're very similar. Sorry. Somebody had a good idea that I stepped on. But RNA and DNA are very similar. They have the same building blocks, which are nucleotides. There's hardly any difference between them. Okay? So that's why we call that transcription. RNA is just a copy of the information in DNA, but what can a cell do with a backup copy of the information in DNA? It can shuttle it out into the cytoplasm, and if it gets damaged, who cares? Because where is that information stored? In DNA. It's safely stored in the DNA inside the nucleus, right? So RNA goes into the cytoplasm. It leaves the nucleus. It can sometimes be transported through the nuclear envelope, or it can go through those nuclear pores that we saw. That's why they're so big, to allow that RNA to leave. Okay? All right, so RNA and DNA use the same language, same characters, so you can just make a photocopy of it. And when you have a photocopy, you know, you could rip this up, and I could say, well, that's okay, because I have the original copy. Right? So another way of thinking of the nucleus, I think about it as a part of the library. What part of the library has very special books that you can't even take out of the library? The reference section. So think of the nucleus as a reference section of the library. Right? You can photocopy those books, and you can burn the photocopies, nobody cares, but don't ever burn those books in the reserve section because they're way too valuable. Yeah. It's modified a little bit, but let's just say for this class it's the same. Okay, yeah. When you take the information from DNA and you convert it to RNA, it's a high fidelity process. No information is lost. For this class, we'll say that. Okay? So you could do this, you could make some RNA from the DNA this year, and you could come back in 20 years and make that information from DNA again, convert it into RNA, and those two RNAs from now and in 20 years will be exactly the same. So there's no changing of that information. All right? That's what we call transcription. Why do we call that transcription? Because it's basically it's the same building blocks. You're just making a photocopy of it. The building blocks are the same. Okay? But there are different kinds of RNA that the cell has to make. The first one is used to make ribosomes. So we call that ribosomal RNA or rRNA. And what is that again? That's the workbench where protein is made. Okay? Now, in order to make a protein, there has to be instructions on how to make it. And those instructions are carried in an RNA molecule. And in particular, we call that messenger RNA or mRNA. That determines what amino acids are joined together to make a protein. So the messenger RNA carries the message on how to build a particular protein. So we just call it mRNA. That's actually the longest, the biggest kind of RNA molecule. And then the third kind is what we call a transfer RNA or tRNA. In order to make a protein, you have to bring amino acids to a ribosome. I don't know if I have a picture of it. In order to make a protein out of it, and amino acids are carried to the workbench to be incorporated into a protein via a transfer RNA. So sometimes I like to call a transfer RNA a taxi RNA. Like if you want to get from one place to another, sometimes you hop on a taxi. Well, amino acids hop on a taxi RNA to go from one part of the cell in the cytoplasm over to a ribosome to be built into a protein. Okay. So there are different genes in chromosome. A gene is a part of a chromosome that is just a sequence of nucleotides that is a set of instructions for making one particular protein. All right, so this is a little bit kind of an old theory, but this is what we thought when I was going through school. All right, and that is that if your body makes 10 different kinds of proteins, how many different kinds of genes do you need? You need 10 genes. Okay. If your body makes 50 different proteins, you need 50 different genes. All right. So a gene is just some information, a length of information in DNA, which is an instruction for making a particular protein. We now know it's a little bit more complicated. We know now one gene can make different kinds of proteins depending on different circumstances inside the body. All right. So bottom line, transcription, where does it take place? Inside the nucleus. And how are you going to know that that's the first step of protein synthesis? How are you going to know we call that transcription? Because it's a weird word, unless you look it up. How are you going to know what transcription means? It means just making a duplicate copy, and it's transcription because DNA and RNA are the same kind of molecule, has the same building blocks. Okay. Second step does not take place. Second step of protein synthesis does not take place in the nucleus. Takes place in the cytoplasm. Because the RNA is free to leave the nucleus. You can always make more if it gets damaged. Right? And that information is used to make a protein. And we call that step translation. What is the name of the organelle where translation takes place? The name of the organelle that actually builds a protein. Okay? The organelle, that's the workbench for making a protein, is the ribosome. All right? And if you said rough endoplasmic reticulum, you're really close, because what does a rough ER have? What does it have? It has ribosomes, so it can make proteins. Okay? Now, we don't call this transcription. We call this translation. Another kind of big word. You could look it up in Wikipedia. But what does translation mean? Everybody knows what translation means, too. If you think about it, it means what? Going from one language to another language. Right? It's the same information. You should not lose information. You just go from one language to another. Like, give me one language. Spanish. Going to? English. That's translation. Right? Or Farsi to Hindi, that's translation. Or English to German, that's translation. Right? So the words are different, the language is different, but what? The information, if you translate properly, is exactly the same. All right, so we call this step translation because what's the building block of protein? Amino acid. So the language of a protein is amino acid. And what's the building block of RNA? We call that nucleotide. So the language is different. You're going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. We call that translation. That happens outside the nucleus in the cytoplasm. All right, so that's the level at which I want you to understand protein synthesis. How many steps?
Two.
You got to know what step number one is called. Transcription. Probably why it's called transcription. Where does it take place? In the nucleus, because DNA can never leave. The second step is called translation. Where does it take place? Cytoplasm or cytosol. All right? And it's called translation because RNA language is different than protein language. Right? The building blocks are different. Okay. So that's what I would like for you to know about protein synthesis. And that, this is a good place to start. Information just goes from DNA to RNA to protein in one-way steps, just like that. Okay, last part of this chapter is cell division. And let me know if you can see the board. I'm not sure you can see the board. If not, I'll blind you. I'll turn a light on. If I get a really dark marker, I bet you can see it. Oh, that's not bad. Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. Do you see that? What's that?
DNA.
Okay, good. You can see the board. DNA. Okay. RNA. Both of these things are what we call nucleic acids. Okay, these are nucleic acids. And the building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide. So, in terms of another important biological molecule in your body, there's something called a protein. Is a protein similar to nucleic acid or similar to nucleotide? Okay. So nucleic acids are to proteins as nucleotides are to amino acids. All right. So that's really how I would like for you to know those terms. Amino acids, building block of protein. Nucleotide, building block of nucleic acid. And since RNA and DNA are made of nucleotides going from one to the other. We call that transcription. Going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language, that's translation. And then you just got to remember where in the cell that takes place. Okay, so mitosis. This is what mitosis does for us. We can start with a single cell right over here, and then it's going to grow and it's going to divide into two separate cells. And it just so happens that in our body, anybody know how many chromosomes a human cell has? It's got 46 chromosomes. Okay, it's a little bit special arrangement, but I don't know if we'll talk about that right now. But when these cells divide, guess how many chromosomes you end up with within these two cells? You know what? It should be the same, 46, because 46 chromosomes means you're a human, right? You don't want to produce any other kind of cells but human cells inside your body, right? So that it should have the same number of chromosomes. So this is what we call the parent cell, and these are what we call the daughter cells. Daughter cells, right here. All right. Furthermore, these daughter cells are the same. They're identical. There's nothing different between these two daughter cells. And you know what? There should be no difference between the daughter cells and the parent cell for the process of what? Mitosis. That's what we're talking about, mitosis. So mitosis is a kind of cell division where the daughter cells are exactly like the parent cell. So why would you want to undergo mitosis in your body? And a lot of students are just going to say, well, to reproduce. Well, yes, this is reproduction, but that's not really what I'm getting at. Okay, this is, yeah, now I think we're thinking really good, okay? Because sometimes there might be some cells that get damaged, they get old, or they get damaged somehow, they die, and what do you want to do? You want to replace them. You want to make new cells. So you just go to another cell and replace old and damaged cells. So that's the first one. Okay, so replace old or dead cells. That's one reason for mitosis. And do you think that's a pretty important process? Yeah? Who can maybe give me an example of why you want to replace old and damaged cells? When you get cut, yeah, you need to replace those things, that damage to your body. I got another pretty good example for you. Is a million a big number? Or kind of not such a big number anymore, but a million to me is still a pretty big number, right? All right, and you have a certain kind of cell in your blood. We call these red blood cells. They carry oxygen all over your body, which you need to stay alive. And does anybody know how many red blood cells die every second in your body? Okay, thousands, you're really close. Actually, between 2 and 3 million red blood cells die in your body every single second. That's a huge number, that's huge. Well, what happens, what do you call that condition when you run out of red blood cells? What do we call that? That's anemia, right? That's anemia. So in order to prevent you from having anemia, how many cells does your body have to build? How many red blood cells does your body have to build every second? 2 to 3 million every second you have to build by this process right here of mitosis. That's just one system. All right, so you're really busy all the time doing stuff. One thing is making red blood cells. All right, so replace old and damaged cells is another one. And the second reason for mitosis is... Okay, growth. I like growth. G-R-O-W-T-H. We might talk about this in here sometime, and that is, at some point in your life, you were just a single cell. When an ovum from your mom was fertilized by sperm from your dad, you became that single cell. And just for fun, does anybody know what that single cell was called? Okay, yeah, don't tell me your name. It's true, that was you, but... Generally speaking, we just call that a zygote, right? A zygote was just a single cell, and then by mitosis, you start to accumulate cells, right? And so the second purpose of mitosis is growth, which is really important because as a zygote, you could never take anatomy notes. I mean, you could sit there and listen all day long, but I don't even think you would learn anything just being a zygote. All right, so growth is real important. Mitosis does that for us. All right, so mitosis has a number of different phases. So what's the difference between the parent cell and the daughter cell?
Nothing.
The daughter and the parent? Nothing. All right, the daughter, nothing. You could think of these two daughter cells in like science fiction language as being clones of each other because they're identical. Okay? All right. So that process of mitosis has a different number of phases. And here are the phases in a kind of classical description. Interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. Actually, mitosis starts right here at prophase. Interphase is a growth phase. It's not a phase where the cell is splitting apart. It's a phase where the cell gets ready to split apart via mitosis. But I include it here anyway just to come up with an acronym. And an acronym is just a word that helps you say something that's a little bit complicated very quickly or to help you memorize a list of other words that might be hard to memorize. All right, so here is an acronym, IPMAT. You might say, well, that's not any more easy to remember than just this list of words. But it's actually not too bad right now because, for instance, if there is an accident on a 405 of a diesel tanker and diesel gets spilled all over the freeways, what are the people, what's the name of that group of people that has specialized training to go clean that spill up? Yeah, hazmat, right? So it's a hazardous material crew. All right, so we say hazmat now. So hazmat kind of rhymes with IPMAT a little bit. All right, so this will help you remember the order of the phases of mitosis. So I stands for? Yeah, the first letter in interphase, right? P is just the first letter of prophase right here. Okay. Well, you're going to have to know what these things look like and what's happening during these different phases of mitosis. So here is the whole cell cycle, including interphase. All right, so interphase starts right at the end of mitosis. So all of this is interphase right here. This is different numbers of growth phases. I don't think I'm going to ask you about G1S and G2. But if you're interested in this, your text has a pretty good description of what's happening during these different parts of interphase. But remember, interphase, that's when the DNA is being used. I don't see chromosomes right here because it is all extended. It's being used. All right, and what is the place inside the nucleus that is being used the most? Okay, that's the, somebody said nucleolus. Yeah, that's the most active part of the nucleus. That's where transcription is taking place at the highest rate, is inside the nucleolus. All right, and when the cell has grown and it's ready to divide, it starts in prophase. That's the first phase, followed by metaphase, then anaphase, and telophase. That's the last phase of mitosis. So let's see what these phases look like. All right, let's really zoom in to these areas. And maybe you could even see pictures exactly like this on the practicum, your first practicum in lab. All right, so what are we looking, maybe I could zoom in one more time. Maybe if I zoom in here, oh, good, how's that? Okay. All right, so chromosomes are going, or chromatin is going to condense into chromosomes so that you can actually see chromosomes inside the nucleus. Why is chromatin going from extended to condensed? Because when it does so, what happens? It becomes protected, right? Because during mitosis, what has to happen to the nuclear envelope? It has to break down, and when it breaks down, the chromosomes can be damaged, but if they're packaged properly in those histones, they don't. All right, but when the cell is in interphase, the DNA is being used for protein synthesis, and I don't see chromosomes, so if we look inside the nucleus, it should be all just nice and homogeneous, extended chromatin during interphase. All right, and so don't forget, did I tell you I was colorblind? That's too bad for you guys because I can't describe what I see right here, but it kind of looks blue right here. That's the That's the chromosomes or the chromatin inside the nucleus, this thing that looks yellow right here. That would be, for instance, like the centrosome or the centrioles that are organizing the microtubules. Because what's the function of the microtubules again? It's going to move things around inside the cell, right? It gives a cell its shape, but it's going to move things around inside the cell. And what it's getting prepared to do is to move chromosomes around inside the cell. So it's stained a little bit different color. And these probably are like microfilaments, and that maybe looks a little bit orange or something to me. All right, so this, I would say, is interphase, because I only see one centrosome. I don't see any chromosomes here. That means the nuclear envelope is still intact. And if we look at an illustration of that, so this is a micrograph. That's a real picture of a cell. All right, we see the nuclear envelope. We see chromatin. It says condensed, but actually during interphase it should be extended. It should be used. All right, and then the first phase is what we call prophase. Chromatin goes from an extended form to condensed. And when it's condensed, you see, what do you see there? You see chromosomes, right? Nicely packaged on histone molecules. This is an early phase of prophase because the nuclear envelope is still here. But one of the goals of prophase is to have the nuclear envelope dissolve. All right, so prophase means condensation of chromatin into chromosomes, the disappearance of the nuclear envelope, and maybe you can even see these centrosomes that have been duplicated during interphase start to separate and move to opposite poles of the cell. So this over here looks like late prophase to me. All right, so prophase, nuclear envelope disappears. The chromosomes still have a nice random arrangement of where they used to be inside the nucleus, and they're going to be positioned, right, when they attach to the spindle apparatus and the microtubule system, right, and the chromosomes are going to attach at the kinetochore, which is the center part of the chromosome, to the microtubules and hop a ride on the microtubules and get positioned just right. So when I see chromosomes right here, nice condensed chromatin, but it still looks nice and random to me. It just kind of random. All right, the next phase, what's the next phase? This is the easiest phase to see, because what happens during prophase is that the chromosomes hop a ride on the chromatin and are positioned exactly on the equator of the cell. So all the chromosomes line up. That's metaphase, and that is right here. All right, so metaphase, we see the chromosomes all lined up. We see the nice spindle apparatus on either end attached to two centrosomes. Chromosomes have all lined up. That's metaphase. And then during anaphase, these chromosomes separate. So let me kind of tell you what's happening here. So on this parent cell, we had 46 chromosomes. Let me draw just one chromosome. At the beginning of interphase, one chromosome, can you see that? Just kind of looks like a bow tie, right? But if we're going to separate all the organelles and all of the chromosomes into two daughter cells, what do we have to do to this thing so that we end up with the same number of chromosomes in the daughter cells? We got to make a copy of this guy here, right? That happens during interphase. We call that replication of DNA. So during interphase, right, that chromosome is replicated and it looks like this little X thing, right? And so don't forget, here's that kinetochore. That's where they're attached right there. So in order for both daughter cells to get a copy, one copy of that chromosome, these things have to separate. They have to split apart. And that happens during this phase of mitosis that we were just talking about, where, and we call these chromatids, right? Sister chromatids separate during anaphase. So you can see the sister chromatids, other people call them daughter chromosomes, separate. That's during anaphase. And again, you can see them being pulled apart. Now that should look different to you compared to prophase. Prophase is what? Random, all over the place. Here I see a nice line of separation. All right, so that's a nice giveaway to whether it's prophase or anaphase. And then the last phase is telophase. The chromatids are right up against the centrosomes, right? And the cells start to pinch apart. This is what we call, there's going to be a depression in the parent cell. We call that a cleavage furrow. And the cytoplasm then gets pinched into two daughter cells during telophase. And also during telophase, the nuclear envelope starts to be rebuilt around the chromosomes. And some of the chromosomes might immediately start to be pulled apart into extended chromatin for protein synthesis. That's something that can happen during telophase. Okay, so don't forget about this cleavage furrow. Happens during telophase. That's the last phase. And the process of splitting the parent cell into two daughter cells, separating the cytoplasm into two different cells and making a nice cell membrane right here, that's what we call cytokinesis. Cyto just means the cell. Kinesis means moving around. It's moving around the organelles and cytoplasm into two separate daughter cells. That's cytokinesis. And in this class, be careful with your lab instructors. They might want a little bit more from you. But in this class, in lecture, where does cytokinesis take place? What phase of mitosis? Telophase. That's right. And in this class, you could say, well, it ends at telophase. Cytokinesis ends in telophase, starts in telophase, ends in telophase. You know, but that's something that we'll probably be discussing for the next 100 years. Some cells, cytokinesis might begin in anaphase and progress into other phases of mitosis. But in here, just say cytokinesis is a process that happens in telophase. And that's good for me. Okay, but you might have to build on that information a little bit later on. So, I think that's it. With one last question. Oh, where's the sign-in sheet? Don't lose the sign-in sheet. And everybody sign the sign-in sheet? Okay, make sure you find it. It's going to find its way down to the front here. Sign it on your way out. What is cytokinesis? That's the separation of the cytoplasm. And what is mitosis? Is the separation of chromosomes. Right, so you can think of the difference between cytokinesis and mitosis that way. Careful of these stairs. I'm going to turn a light on right away. See ya. All right, have a nice weekend. Kinetochore might be a little bit more descriptive because it might include some specific proteins that are in the centromere. Centromere, I think, is a little bit more general.
Okay.
Okay. The centromere is where these two chromosomes attach. The kinetochore is some extra attachment points that allow it to hook up to a microtubule.
Oh, okay.
But it also includes the centromere.
All right, thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Can I just do now?
All right, yeah.
Okay.